All right, welcome to one of the final panels of Dragon Con 2018. Every year I have a panel around this time, and I'm always impressed by the people that are here. So I just want to say thank you very much, because I feel like this is a very important topic. And even if you're recovering from a hangover, that's fine. I appreciate everyone being here, and it's really heartening to see people here on a Monday and spending their time this way. So we're here basically to discuss, you know, propaganda and artificial intelligence as it relates to propaganda. So I figure a good way to start would be to give a quick primer of kind of what propaganda is. Does anyone have any idea of, or how would they would define propaganda? No one. I take back the heartening comment.
It is Monday. It is Monday.
Anyone, go ahead, sir. Okay, did everybody kind of hear that? Basically, he's saying that when you're communicating a message to someone, you're insinuating certain messages into that message in order to essentially, you know, change someone else's thoughts surreptitiously without them realizing it or having the ability to critically think about it. That's one, I would argue, method of propaganda.
I might say that could be good propaganda. Bad propaganda could just be stating the message over and over again.
Right. Yeah.
I would say that propaganda is preventing information in selective or biased ways so as to encourage either some kind of action or some kind of inaction.
Great. And those are all excellent answers. And my research leads to that. Those definitions, there's psychological, there's sociological, now there's technological. There's multiple avenues, and sort of, you know, thinking about the last couple days, to me, it's sort of the antithesis of free will. And to put it in the most general sense of the way I understand it, is that you're no longer really concerned, the person sending the message is no longer concerned with allowing the recipients to make their own decisions. And whether they use psychological trickery, inherent biases, repetition or other sort of psychological or sociological or technological tricks to take away that freedom of thought, then I think that would kind of, that's the way I would understand propaganda in a general sense. Go ahead, sir.
Well, by that definition, then virtually every commercial on TV or on the internet is propaganda.
Thank you for mentioning that.
Yes.
Well, to me, propaganda isn't necessarily nefarious or in trying to trick anyone. It's advertising for a political purpose. You're trying to convince someone of a political position. Obviously, you're not going to get both sides, because you're not trying to be news. Propaganda is, by definition, one-sided, but it's not necessarily disreputable or anything like that. I mean, propaganda should be properly understood distinctly from news reporting, for instance, but it's not inherently any worse than advertising in general.
Correct, and one man's propaganda could be another person's marketing. And are you familiar with a guy named Edward Bernays? He's essentially the father of propaganda, or he's commonly referred to as the father, but here I have a book for you.
And also the father of public relations.
Father of public relations or propaganda, and his book, obviously titled Propaganda, has been around for decades and decades, but he was well known. He did a lot of work with, you know, Dodge, Dow Chemical, other companies. I guess his most famous example would be to convince females to smoke cigarettes by calling them like freedom sticks. Yes. And so a lot of like modern marketing and propaganda, or however you want to call it, kind of stemmed from him and has been refined over time. I'll let the other panels speak more.
I just wanted to say he got into the private sector after working on the Committee on Public Information, which was the US's domestic propaganda organization during World War I, targeted at, you know, building support for the war effort. And so left, you know, had that military experience disseminating information, and then sort of brought that to the private sector. Yeah.
Oh, I'm Blair Chintella. I'm an attorney here in Georgia, based in Kennesaw in Cartersville area. I've been speaking on these issues for, this is my seventh year now. So.
I'm Jairus Khan. I work with the Mozilla Foundation on issues of internet health, and I'm a general malcontent.
My name's Carl Grindel. I'm a graduate student at the Georgia Institute of Technology right down the street, and I've been studying Russian propaganda mostly through RT with a professor named Dr. Klein in the public policy department.
How many of the things you guys just said are true?
That's
three out of four.
There'll be a test at the end of this.
Passing around are examples, and who here knows that, or knows of, you know, the Facebook and Twitter and Russia being involved in those? Okay, so what I'm handing around now are examples that Facebook disclosed to Congress and that Congress released to the public. My understanding is that not all of the examples were released, but a lot of them were, and you could really see Russia injecting strife into our political system. You know, supporting both sides of an issue, for example, gun rights. What are some other examples you guys can think of?
There was gun rights, there was Black Lives Matter, there was immigration issues, there was pro and anti-vaccine. What I find most amazing about this is how sophisticated it is, right? Like how it really does feel natural. Like it doesn't feel like, oh, this is, you know, clearly, you know, you think Russian propaganda, you think World War II, constructivist strongmen. But, I mean, this is like, you know, this looks like it's, you know, a 12-year-old made it in a good way, right? You're like, oh, this is clearly from a high school kid or clearly from an academic or clearly from whatever it is that it's masquerading as.
I would partially agree with the sophistication of it and partially not. You know, when you see the number of impressions they got, there's, like, it's effective, but it's effective to people that are already predisposed, potentially, to relate to that content in a specific way. And so part of the segmenting of targeting two different audiences on a conflicting issue is so that, as we talk more about the AI component of personalized propaganda, creating content that people relate to. But it's not like you see an image and you're all going to be, you know, marching to Washington in a minute. It's harder than that.
Right. It's not necessarily compelling. It's just convincing.
Yeah, and that was another aspect of this essentially influence campaign, as they're calling it, to where it's targeted to people who are predisposed to adopt those beliefs. And that's why you'll see in the news sometimes they'll refer to the voting rolls being hacked, but no vote tallies were changed. Well, that's not really the purpose of why they were hacking it. The purpose was to get people's information and demographics, and then so they could target them sort of in another route to change their beliefs that way, rather than just going changing numbers in the computer. That's too easily detectable. So, yes, sir.
Hi, Laurie. Hold up. Did some reading on it. One of the things that I saw emerging in a number of recent articles. Oh, okay. Speech box. One of the things I saw emerging in a number of recent articles is that a lot of the propaganda was aimed at arguing both sides.
Yep.
So they would take one side of the issue and then some of the same groups putting it out would also argue the other side of the issue. What was really the purpose of doing that? And maybe you just answered it in terms of trying to get demographic segmentation and figuring out how to influence different groups. But was there some other purpose behind doing that?
Well, my perception would be that there's an interesting alignment between foreign propaganda efforts targeted at destabilizing the United States and legitimate protest movements in the United States that are targeting institutions of power and want to, you know, have legitimate concerns. So an interesting parallel in during the civil rights movement back in the 1950s and 60s, the Communist Party USA was supportive of the civil rights movement. And that might have been both tactically, but also some potentially deep-held beliefs. And so you see on the far left and the far right, in particular, frustrations with, you know, corruption in government, potentially through the influence of money in government. You know, that might be a legitimate concern, but something that can be heightened through Russian propaganda in a way that might lead to a certain Washington consensus that is opposed by the Russian government being, you know, attacked or responding to that. So I might think of, like, you know, Pat Buchanan is historically a, you know, more isolationistic. He is a realist. He doesn't want the United States, you know, rushing into war abroad. Russia might be invested in the United States having a more isolationistic foreign policy. That doesn't mean that that's bad or wrong. It's just that those interests align on that issue.
And there was an interview, interesting article in the Washington Post, where they interviewed a worker who used to work for the Internet Research Agency. Does anyone here know what that was, or that is, actually? Well, essentially, it is a group of people who are working for the Russian government, and they're just spewing out mass quantities of propaganda. And they're, whether it be comments to videos, comments to political campaigns, I mean, and this is one thing, and I'll read you what he said, and to answer, I think that answers your question partially. It says, one of three trolls would write something negative about the news. The other two would respond, you are wrong, and post links and such. And the negative one would eventually act convinced. These are the kinds of plays we had to act out. So they're creating this fake, entirely fake conversation. So that's where the sort of the psychology of it comes in. And there's a group thinking component to it. And so, you know, people are online and they see these comments and they glean a consensus or whatever they do, it, you know, influences people's opinions. So it's very sophisticated in that psychological sense too.
To structure some of the conversation, I think it might be useful to think of propaganda by, to use Russia as the continual case study, a portfolio of different techniques. And so one would be buying advertisements on Facebook. That was, you know, a lot of, I think the slides you were handing out were purchased ads. Another would be user-generated content where people are pretending to be, you know, a 20-year-old in Missouri, a 60-year-old in Florida, whatever, and then posting content. So, you know, buying ads is one thing. Pretending to be somebody as sort of a bot is another, although that can have a more technical meaning. Then a third would be actually having your own websites and posting news. So that can be sort of a portfolio of there being new sites that are potentially more likely to be fact-checked. So in my research on RT, I sort of consider that to be a higher quality news product, but they produce other news sites, Sputnik, Duran, that are a lower quality news site. And so your level of capacity within each news site to, like, stray from the truth might vary, you know, in order that you're covering lots of different bases. So anyway, just three things there would be posting as faux people, buying ads, and publishing news are kind of three different methods of sort of all pushing out a parallel message.
Does anyone want to talk about bots?
That's a great topic.
Sure. I think we all have kind of the idea of bots as being these kind of automated things that live on Twitter, that probably there's a program somewhere churning things out. And to some extent, that's true for some of them. But what's happening right now is a lot more sophisticated in that. And preface this with a big, this is what we understand, because we don't have a man on the inside, but this is kind of what we've been able to understand from research that's been done. There are a lot of Twitter accounts that are kind of automated, simple, pushing out messages, retweeting things. there's another level of them where people have people who've died or left Twitter or lost their email accounts that have a legitimate Twitter history, their accounts get hacked, get taken over, and those become part of kind of the propaganda machine. And these are more convincing because, you know, well, this person has been on Twitter for 8 years talking about other things, so now they're talking about this one issue, so probably they're a legitimate human. And then there are kind of larger fake institutional accounts that are clearly run by a person all the time, or individual people, because they have a larger audience. I think the Tennessee Republican Party Twitter was one of the bigger ones that was not from Tennessee or Republican. And there's also kind of hybrid accounts which are happening, where you'll have accounts that appear to be mostly automated, but humans will jump in every now and then for big conversations or for posts that are going to be amplified by the rest of the network. So they definitely look real in those moments. And that way you can have a large amount of accounts that are mostly automated and a small number of people controlling them, kind of hopping from account to account to account to show that they're actually people.
And it kind of raises one of the problems it raises is that legitimate news sources will oftentimes pick up that information and start, you know, incorporating it into their news cycle. And so it's really tough to, like, discern whether these are legitimate sources or whether it's just straight propaganda. I mean, a lot of this stuff, I wish I could remember their examples I handed out, but, you know, it's just people's names like Jane Smith or something, but it was really funded by the Russian government. So it's really hard to determine, you know, Black Lives Activists, you know, from North Carolina or something. And they're going so far as to, like, organize rallies, buy supplies for rallies, buy megaphones, here's some money we're going to send you, that kind of thing. So, and then the participants just go out and do the rally, and it's coming from St. Petersburg, Russia, you know, where the Internet Research Agency is located. So, it's really fascinating.
Well, why exactly does it matter?
I mean, if you had a reporter, why exactly does it matter? If a reporter was dumb enough to take an internet blog argument as a source of news and repost that in a news story, they're just depending on a source that they shouldn't depend on, because nobody can prove any of the things that they say in these blogs. It's just claims. So if they're willing to take a claim and misrepresent it as a proven fact, then it hardly matters where it originates from, real person or bot. And since all bots are ultimately programmed by people anyway, it's all ultimately coming from people. It's not like there's an AI out there that's thinking of things on its own. So,
and I think what you're getting at is, like, if the idea is the same, who cares where it comes from? And I thought about that as well. I mean, and I think it comes back to wanting to have a genuine discussion in our democracy for America, not have, like, an outside power injecting its beliefs or skewing the argument. So, like, for example, police brutality is an issue. I'm not going to say it's not an issue. But if you have 10,000 Russian trolls blowing it up, and people are getting, you know, agitated by it, and are fighting in the streets, and people are dying, then that's not the same as having a legitimate, bona fide discussion about it with our citizenry. That's the difference I would see. Correct. Right. Well, other countries, that's a free speech issue, yeah.
So I'm just going to share that I think it's also important to put the level of propaganda the U.S. is currently receiving in perspective. And so if you look at, there is a European Union-based organization that tracks propaganda in Europe. And Eastern European countries are flagged as having far more sort of propaganda-produced memes. I think the word memes is kind of appropriate here. So if people are familiar with memetics, it's the idea that information can spread like genes. And so, you know, successful ideas continue to get spread, and that they propagate that way. And so if facts about military exercises in Russia, facts about whether or not in Ukraine the dissidents are fascists or pro-democracy are, like, challenges that can get propagated. So at least according to the European Union's account, I don't know if you saw, there was a Netflix story about these like white helmets in Syria, you know, people providing medical relief on the ground. And the Russian meme or story was to basically say that Al-Qaeda had somehow infiltrated these medical relief teams, and that was spread through legitimate media publications. Now, you know, it's hard because I'm not a Syrian expert. You know, I presume it's not true. You know, you read the things that you can, but it's hard to say like what's happening in a small neighborhood in Syria, particularly when you know, there's misinformation being spread intentionally. And so I think the challenge is not necessarily that, you know, the Republican, for us, we might be experiencing the fake Republican Party of Tennessee, but it's, I think, a little harder to for Eastern Europeans or understanding international news where Russia might be creating facts as well as fiction.
Yeah, and I think this is, you know, part of the problem of where we're going to end up, or could end up with the issue of AI being applied to it. That what we see right now as okay, well, you know, these conversations may or may not be legitimate. It's going to become a lot harder very soon to determine what legitimate looks like.
Maybe would this be a fun place to also talk about Cambridge Analytica?
Absolutely.
As sort of bordering that legitimacy question.
Absolutely. Me?
No.
Well, we have some questions.
I just want to say that it also, if you see these posts or whatnot, then you go and Google them. There's legitimate looking websites that are then supporting that. You're like, oh, okay. But then you dig deeper into that. And so it becomes almost a full-time job to find out what's real and what's not. And just people don't have time for that, you know?
Yeah.
And people aren't equipped for it, right? Like, there isn't, you know, a high school class about how to determine, you know, foreign propaganda in your news, right? So we just don't have the skills to do that on a regular basis or the time, right? Like every Facebook post that you see, you don't have the time to fact check everything. No one does.
Hey, I was wondering if you, maybe you already did, would you make the distinction between AI and just machine learning? Because I think that causes a lot of confusion. AI is really scary. Machine learning is scary, but in a very different and dumb way, I think.
So, I think the important distinction there is machine learning, you know, can involve neural nets, it involves feeding in information and then predicting, you know, what should come out by creating a sort of a testing loop. I'm not the technologist, so I'll let the technologist describe that better. But I was just going to say that, like, for machine learning to be effective, it's going to need your information before it can predict something about you. And so once we get more to the technological side here, maybe this also gets us into the Cambridge Analytica, but like how you're categorized as a person will determine, and the amount of data that's been collected will determine the efficacy of the machine learning. Right. So machine learning is not necessarily effective. Okay, so just to jump to Cambridge Analytica for a sec, like they claim that they can categorize people based on some psychological profile. So the psychological profile is something called the Big Five in psychology, or OCEAN: openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, neuroticism, and I'm forgetting what the A stands for. Anyway. But like those five factors, you know, might describe your personality in some broad sense. But it's also, I think that makes it less scary to me to know, like, you know, they're talking about five factors. It's the best that psychology has today for personality development. But if I tell you I'm in, you know, ENTP, I don't know if that necessarily gives you enough information to convince me of something based on that alone.
They've been doing it for a long time.
Well, yes. I think one of the things that came out from that Cambridge Analytica was they had developed like a way to psychologically profile you based on your likes. And so they even narrowed it, they pinned it at like with 70 likes, knowing what things you liked and getting that information about you, like your Facebook profile or something, we could determine like your skin color to a certain 97 percentile, your political beliefs, your sexual orientation, and all these facts based off your likes. And then with like 150, we knew you better than your excuse me, better than your friends. And with like 300, we knew better than your parents. And then there's like another one above that where they could predict your behavior more than you could. Like they knew more about you than yourself, in a sense.
But that's where the information you feed in
right.
adds to the efficacy of
absolutely
the
yeah.
machine learning.
Right. Yeah.
None of that's true.
I concur with that.
Well, you're just basing off what we say, which you know.
No. Are you going to say, and it actually works, or this is just what they're?
I mean, whether Cambridge Analytica themselves were or were not able to predict with that amount of accuracy, other people can. Amazon definitely can. Facebook definitely can. Netflix definitely can. And I mean, we might.
Is that true at that level of accuracy?
Yes, is the short answer. Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to those specific levels of accuracy, but I mean. Well, I mean, I can't speak to those specific numbers, but I mean, if you know, I think everyone has had the moment where they're like, oh, I've had this conversation about this thing, and now Facebook is showing me an ad because they're, you know, are they checking out my microphone? They're not listening to your microphone. The reality is that they are so good at knowing what it is you're going to need and when you're going to need it that from your already existing behavior, their psychometric profile of you can say, you know, probably this here's the 20 ads that are going to match something that's coming up now, because we know what you want, we know what your friends want, we know what your friends are buying, we know what like ad retargeting pixels we're getting from Facebook ads, we know which of your friends' posts you're clicking like on. So it's a really sophisticated system, and it's honestly much more scary than if Facebook just had someone listening to your microphone, because at least that's easy. But the reality is you can build very, very accurate predictive profiles at scale of populations.
I think the important thing there is, though, at the population level, and the fact that these are correlations,
right.
not perfect predictions. So just because, you know, I like Game of Thrones, and Amazon might figure that out, they can throw me a bunch of Game of Thrones action figures, and I might think that's great, but the chance that I buy any one, you know, is probably pretty low.
Yeah.
Well, there's the old story with basically the Amazon profile, where after taking a look at the I think viewing habits and purchasing of the teenage daughter, they basically figured out she was pregnant.
Yeah.
That was Target, and they changed their advertising because of that, because they got busted. But they could one of their people said they could predict within, I think it was like 4 weeks, your due date based on your purchases. And that was 10 years ago,
yeah.
right? They've been doing this for a while. Big data is not a new thing.
Yeah,
no. But I think it's also important that Target and Amazon are probably way better at this than Cambridge Analytica.
That skill set has been developing
yes.
for a long time.
Yeah.
Right?
That's the future tense.
You know,
yeah, and this is kind of
reapplying.
Part of the big problem, right, is that technology is becoming easier and cheaper and faster and more accessible.
I'd like you to address, you've addressed kind of the receiving of propaganda in the U.S., but what about us sending it out to other countries? And to follow up on your comment about hacking the voter rolls, I mean, I actually worked for the Obama campaign, and we actually got hacked by China and Russia. It happened again this year with Vote Builder, which is the voter file of the DNC, was attacked again. But you can get all of the voter rolls from every state, you know, for about $500. So is it really necessary to potentially expose their intelligence operation instead of setting up a front company
ordering the voter files from each state and then sending that on to St. Petersburg from there.
Hmm. So I'll maybe speak
to... Yeah, they had social curing. They had other stuff besides, yeah.
I was just going to speak to U.S. propaganda efforts abroad, which is that the United States, after having a bunch of organizations focused on propaganda during World War I, World War II, ended up creating something called the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which is an independent body, but whose heads are appointed by the president for terms that extend beyond the terms of a single presidency. And so that agency receives money from Congress to basically put forward a pro-American message through radio and websites to authoritarian states. And so Cuba, China are getting broadcasted American news. It's, you know, it's partially independent from the United States. And it's, you know, not being designed in a way to deceive the public, but you also don't really get a lot of negative American news. You might get, you know, some critical American news, but talking about something going on of importance, but it's not, you know, it's pretty pro-American. It's more pro-American than CNN.
I think you're referring to Voice of America.
Yes, Voice of America is one of their media publications.
So that's sort of like RT, essentially.
Yes, yes. Yes, and so because it's covert. Yeah, so I think at the covert level, it's hard to describe like what is specifically going on. I know, like if you jump back to the Marshall Plan, the U.S. government funded, you know, suitcases of cash to non-communist parties in. Italy, you know, so the U.S. has its fair share of trying to manipulate elections abroad in our history, but I think it's very hard to know what's going on now at that level. But the Broadcasting Board of Governors is what we know, and that's, I think, the other propaganda dimension, when you think about these fake accounts online that I think is kind of interesting, is the U.S. Tries to catch potential terrorists by impersonating terrorist organizations and recruiting, and then before the person participates in a crime, you know, catching them and putting them in jail. And so that seems like a potentially interesting, valid form of you know, these fake accounts. And to the degree that it could be automated and made cheaper, might be a good thing. But then, you know, how do you start to distinguish between what is a good form of government-based impersonation, you know, versus a bad form of government-based impersonation? And I think all of these issues are going to be decided by the platforms.
Well, the good uses are the ones I agree with, I'm pretty sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that seems fair.
Yeah, and that's something that is fluid. I mean, nobody in their no human being makes a decision in their life that has not been influenced to some degree by somebody else on the planet. So, like, whether it's your parents, whether it's your teachers, whoever. So to make a Blair Chantella decision doesn't exist. I mean, we all have to recognize that basic fact that we were raised by parents. We had instructors who taught us things, and they all have become sort of part of our personality. So it's like, where do you draw the line? How surreptitious of a message becomes propaganda versus it's just a strong argument? And so that's why for me, kind of the definition comes back to whether the message you're receiving really empowers you to make your own decision, makes you think critically, or whether it takes advantage of your mental weakness of human nature as far as, you know, herd mentality and those kinds of things. So, yes, I think it would. A lot of advertising campaigns and stuff. Yeah. But the more you're aware of it, the more you are prepared to deal with it.
Yeah, I have a quick question. Could you just let's talk about perhaps maybe the limits of propaganda? And for example, you mentioned correlation. For example, like, how do you know that it's more, the government is more ineffective now, and it might not necessarily be that, you know, the Russians are so much more effective. What if government is just less, or just more lazy, or they're not doing what they used to do? And, you know, like, how do you really know, you know, how useful it is? Because I'm pretty sure that there are other countries that don't have these issues, probably in the Nordic regions, where they're not really seriously saying that because they have strong educational systems, i.e.
So intriguingly, the Nordic regions are really being equally, you know, targeted by Russian propaganda. I think things you might look at would be, though, trust and governance. And there you might see differences between countries in terms of the efficacy of propaganda in removing sort of social trust. I think another sort of question of efficacy to your point would be how much, you know, if you count the number of stories, the number of impressions, there might be metrics-based ways, I just think like an academic, to measure what's going on here. And there's been some work in that dimension to try and count impressions, and that's been, I think, particularly successful with the ads purchased on Facebook, but gets, you know, more distributed when you talk about the websites they have.
Yeah, and it's also highly cultural, right? Like, the type of propaganda that works in one place is, you know, maybe totally ineffective in other places. Cambridge Analytica worked as part of the Kenyan election in a legitimate capacity to you know, work for one of the parties there. But they didn't understand the way the Kenyan political process worked on a social level. They didn't understand the way that Kenyans made decisions about politics, and it was not effective at all there for them, despite it being a playbook that could have worked really, really well elsewhere. So I think it a part of it is whether you have the expertise to know how propaganda works on the specific population you're targeting.
I think it's also interesting that, like, you know, China has their own propaganda organizations, and they tend to have a message that's basically like, China's great, nothing to worry about here. And so that ends up just not resonating as much if your message is like, you know, China's great, than if it's, you know, how can we get Americans to, like, start, you know, brawling in the streets? That's a more engaging message. And so your click-through rate on a tweet that, like, is something, you know, that just makes your blood boil is going to be higher, or your retweet rate, than just reading, like, you know, China's great.
I was going to say, I don't know the source, and I apologize, but you know, I did read something recently on social media about, you know, there a lot of the stuff that you are presented with, you're targeted based on, they found that the more upset or enraged that you become, the longer you will stay on the platform. You know, how many times does somebody sit there and write a 4-paragraph essay to somebody on something that they completely agree with them on? So I used to have a browser plugin called FB Purity, FB Buster, that removed all ads, so I didn't see ads. I mean, I ended up deleting my Facebook just because, for me, ads don't work. I just report them all as offensive or lewd or nudity or whatever, just to fuck with, excuse me, to mess with the algorithm. But but I guess at some point there surely has to be studies on, you know, the people who ads are not affecting, like, what else, you know, what other avenues do you have? So I'm not going to say that I'm impervious and that I probably am making multiple mistakes on, in disclosing personal details, but I guess, do you know, I don't know, I guess more of a, you know, there's targeted, if people are not exposed, or people kind of liken the fact that, you know, at what point do you decide okay, well, social media is great because it connects with my friends and family, but more and more encroaching, I just keep thinking about Ready Player One, you know, how ads and things slowly and creeping in, you know, that Facebook is becoming, you know, skinnier and skinnier with what you're doing, and lighter and lighter on your friends and family's things and more on other stuff. So, like, at what point do we scrap social media, or, you know, they're making a lot of money off of it, obviously.
Right.
Using it.
Well, let me actually ask a quick question here. How many people here, raise your hand if you would say that you were very susceptible to advertising? Like five, yeah, seven people. How many people here would say that advertising as an industry is effective? Who do you think it's working on? Right? Like everyone thinks that, you know, it works on my friends. It doesn't work on me. And
I don't know. I give the Dragon Kong demographic a little more credit.
I mean, we are here. We are here in this room talking about it. But advertising does work in the same way harassment works, in the same way that any kind of sustained, repeated stimulus has an effect on someone. And I think that when it comes to social media, what a lot of social media has been kind of built on, those algorithms have been built on, is engagement, right? Like, if someone engages with this content, probably it's good content, and we'll promote it and we'll show it to more people, right? So that's like clicks and likes and comments and shares but what's happening is that the content that is getting that engagement is largely content people are pissed off about, right? Like, if you see something and you're like, this is wrong, and you write, this is wrong, you're engaging, right? If you send it to your friends, can you believe this nonsense, and they all, you know, pile on and say, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen, that's a really high engagement post. And so the systems that were kind of built without a lot of thinking as to the, you know, downstream emergent effects of it, have had this impact where they are now bringing to the surface content that is likely to get you to engage, and probably if you're engaging, you know, there's a decent chance that it is an emotion-based reaction. So it's kind of where we ended up.
I think an interesting trend here too has been YouTube's. There's been some recent evidence that, at least in the past couple of years, YouTube sort of drives you to extremes in your videos. So if you think that you want to start jogging and you read about running form, you're going to eventually get videos about, like, ultra marathons. You know, if you're interested in giving up beef, you're going to learn about veganism. You know, if you're interested in immigration policy, you know, you might get the alt-right. And so there's, even if that's not foreign propaganda, I think in terms of how these algorithms drive engagement, engaging with the extremes is something that can sort of move in a one-directional capacity because it keeps you on the platform. I tend to think one great way to sort of help protect yourself from propaganda is intentionality in your choices. So if you're following specific people on Twitter, I think that might be better than letting, you know, the algorithm decide who you should be following, and, you know, letting you sort of be pushed into a certain direction. I think if you care about the institutions of the organizations and try to vet what you think is their editorial process. So, you know, the New York Times is going to have a better quality process of fact-checking than a smaller blog. That doesn't mean you can't follow the smaller blog. It just means that you should be engaged with the fact that, like, there's a spectrum of the quality of news production that's partly based on resources and the time put into each story.
That's a good point. I think we have a question way in the back.
To follow up on the...
No, go ahead, sir.
Go ahead.
Oh, to follow up on that, one, you are correct, because I've actually experienced that YouTube phenomenon myself, and I'll be like, where'd this come from? And it'll be someone that I despise. And I'll be like, that's odd. Anyway, so yes, that I've experienced that myself. But on the topic of the actual shenanigans that is the YouTube algorithm, that as an observation that I have noticed, that whether for what means I don't know, but that a lot of pre-video ads now seem to be being pulled from a similar source in writing, in both the way it is shown with images and video, what have you, and writing. Quit on me. Oh, there we go. In a very similar fashion to the infamous Facebook ads. And that's been an observation that I've seen become abundantly clear about the past year and a half. And a lot of times it'll be completely unrelated to what you're watching. So, sorry. I just thought of that when you said about YouTube.
Yeah. I think there's a lady in the back.
So if the algorithms are a numbers game, right? So if we create a lot of bots that are putting out massive amounts of messages that are measured and try to get to people, give people the tools to make a good decision, would that help?
Well, I mean, it's a numbers game, but it's a really complicated one, right? Like it's not just what video is getting the most engagement. It's what are the videos, you know, not videos or comments or wherever you are. Yeah. It's, you know, what are similar things that person likes? What do people like them like? There's a researcher, actually a Mozilla fellow, who she was doing research on the anti-vax movement. And so she was watching a lot of anti-vax videos on YouTube. And YouTube started strongly recommending to her Pizzagate videos and Truther videos. Because people who are into these things often end up kind of in other things. And so it's hard to know how you can game the system in a way that's effective, right? I mean, it's there are entire industries of people trying to figure out how to game the system and make a lot of money. So it's really, really tough.
I might suggest specifically with YouTube, you can delete your history. And so that's one way to sort of reset a little bit back to zero, you know, with the algorithm. And so keeping, you know, being aware of what information about you is collected and how a profile about you is essentially being made to feed you things that you seemingly like or are more likely to click on, you know, be aware of what that profile contains.
I think the fact that you're bothered by those commercials is a good sign, sir, to reach your question. Because if you just sat there passively watching whatever and you didn't even, like, realize what you're watching is like a certain way, then that's kind of like where they want you. You know, I hate commercials. I can quote them, you know, I watch CNN sometimes, MSNBC or whatever, and I can pretty much quote all of them, and they're so repetitious. I mean, I mean, you watch something 20 times, why the heck aren't you annoyed? You know, if you're not, there's something wrong there. You just become accustomed to it, I think. So.
Yeah, so hold on to that discomfort.
Yeah, hold on to that. These, you know, realize what you're watching over and over and over and over and over.
I wanted to kind of go back to this idea of engagement and ask a couple of questions. One is there a way, has there been research into qualitative measures of engagement? Like, not just that a person clicks through or is engaged, but how deeply or how effective a particular campaign is. And to follow up on that, if so, is there any research to suggest that this differs by age? Because I am a woman of a certain age, and I loathe Facebook. I just loathe it. And I'm not on Twitter. I'm not on Instagram. I am just not interested. I don't want to see pictures of other people's food. I don't want to get hassled by Russian bots.
So I'll just speak to, I think a lot of that research is a little harder to get because it comes on the sort of Google Analytics side of the website. So, you know, the person maintaining a website or a social media profile gets all sorts of great descriptive statistics about their, you know, click-through rate and, like, you know, how many likes they've got and all of that. You can do some of that. So in my work, I've been scraping RT videos. And with that came sort of associated metadata, like data, and, you know, the number of views. And so, you know, I can use that as sort of a proxy. And I'm kind of specifically interested in the ratio of, you know, Russian media figures appearing on the network versus American media figures. And it's way biased in favor of American video, American people on the specific RT show that I scraped. And so I think you come away with these interesting lessons about how propaganda is being spread. But it's hard, I think, to get the demographic information about, you know, I don't know who liked the videos.
Yeah, and social media networks often have widely various age demographics, right? Some social networks are younger than others in that sense, right? Like Instagram is younger than Facebook. You know, Facebook is older than Twitter, you know, depending on what is cool to what audience.
I think we had a question right over here.
Well, there's something that a mathematician that I follow on YouTube made a comment about. It was Vhart, where if someone makes a video based on a certain topic, and I may be misremembering things. If someone makes a video on a certain topic, and it's targeted towards their enemy, basically. The enemy blows up on some certain thing that it was basically just a trap for them, so that they would get angry at the video, post about the video, and show their hand too much. Then anybody who sees the response to it and either doesn't like that person or sees the flaws in their argument or sees that they're harping on this one thing, this one little trap in the previous video, they're more likely to see the previous video because they're feeling like they're being more conscientious as more truthful and that this person just exploded on it.
That's a great description of trolling.
Yeah. Yeah. You just make your enemies hate your video, and then anybody who doesn't like them goes, well, maybe that other person's a pretty cool dude.
Right. Yeah, and this is something that people on places like 8chan have weaponized to extraordinary effect. It is a big problem in that, you know, kind of like fake news, we don't really know how to deal with it, like at kind of the large scale. People, if they see something that is, you know, genuinely infuriating, they get infuriated. And exploiting that is one of the things that makes propaganda really effective.
I do kind of want to point out, too, that I think there are some interesting challenges to, you know, trolling propaganda, where, like, one of the great joys of the internet is a little bit of the Wild West character, you know, that it has had historically, and it being a free space for communication. But clearly, you know, there are serious negative consequences, and so platforms might be able to move in the direction of restricting that kind of content, but it might be at the sacrifice, you know, by sacrificing freedom of speech for specific groups or privacy for people more collectively if there's, you know, more viewing of the materials. So anyway, I just think there are values discussions at play here as to how much, what kind of speech you allow to exist on different platforms.
And we're starting to see that play out, too, with Facebook taking actions to remove ads and Twitter taking down some, what do you call them, Twitter profiles. And then Donald Trump, our president of the United States, is tweeting that they're persecuting conservatives. And so, you know, there's always that risk that it's going to be perceived as censorship and so.
Well, that actually relates to my question. So going back to the Russia-China influence type situations, is there anything being done right now or any plans for anything to be done to fight that sort of propaganda?
We've been fighting it. I know our government's been fighting it. I think it's just become apparent. The battle has become in the public sphere more recently because it involved our election.
But what are we doing? I mean, is there any kind of technological solution? Like, for example, you know, email accounts filter out spam. I mean, is there any kind of technological developments that are being done to fight outside influence?
So, like, Facebook's taken individual steps to review their advertisers more thoroughly and has also, as stated previously, taken steps to remove people that are perceived as being foreign intelligence operations or bots. But that's been at sort of the corporate level, at the request of the government, more or less, but without there being actual regulations in place. So there's an interesting question about what level of internet portal, or you know, how large should a company be to need to validate that its users are legitimate users, and what does that validation entail? Do we want the government looking and making sure everybody has a driver's license or passport? That seems highly invasive. But you would also want these larger platforms to be monitoring their users to some degree. So there's been legislation more on the regulatory side, but it's not gotten up to a vote.
And a legal aspect, too, is that these companies, they have these terms of service. And so, yes, they can remove people based on their terms of service, or they could even censor people, theoretically, because, you know, First Amendment issues don't truly, I guess, legally come into play unless it's government action. You know, it's like you invite someone to your house, you can say, I don't like what you're saying, you need to leave.
Yeah, I mean, Twitter, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, Twitter could say tomorrow we're going to ban anyone who says their favorite color is blue, and you know they're totally within their rights to do that. I think part of the problem that we're going to see soon is it's whether we have kind of legislation like this in place or not. It's going to become much harder to figure out and enforce. I don't know how many people saw that video of Google that Google put out of. I forget what it was called, but basically like Google making a phone call. They called a hair salon, and it sounded like a person, and everyone's like, well, that's scary. Think about what that will look like when that is kind of like easy and cheap, and you can do that at scale on Twitter, right? Like if I'm working on a activist project and I want to get some support behind it, and I can deploy 20,000 Twitter accounts that all have that level of kind of like sophistication in conversation, it's going to be a lot harder to figure out that those are bots and those are in violation of a terms of service than it is now.
And for those who don't know that example, basically, I guess Google had, was it an AI system? That would you characterize it as? I don't know the technical name for it.
Yeah, it's like they've been working on machine learning kind of like for conversation for a really, really long time. So it was an extension of that
work. It was like a machine speaking in a human voice. Sounded like a real person with a certain intonations, and they called a hair salon. It was sort of like a Turing test, if you know that term, where it's can a machine convince a human being that they're really speaking to a human? And the person had no inkling, essentially, and I think it was just a hair salon call or something.
Yeah. And if that's audio, the even scarier thing will be deep fakes, the capacity to like put someone's face on another figure and have them give a speech or make a statement, by digitally cropping their head. So if you look up the word deep fakes, there's a future where you don't know if video is real or not, in a way where people have kind of assumed that video is not being edited, it represents the truth.
Do we have time for one more, or is that?
Yeah.
That's it.
All right.
Okay.
We'll answer questions.
All right. Before everyone goes, thank you for coming again. I have some books I'd like to give out to whoever wants. I have A Clockwork Orange. Who here has read that one? Okay. It's different than the movie. The ending's different. He actually learns his way. He learns to not be an asshole.
Spoilers.
Sorry. All right. Then I have 1984. Who hasn't read it? I'd love to give it to someone to read, but they have to promise to actually try and read it.
Spoiler.
So, and then Manufacturing Consent by Noam Chomsky.
This is the gem.
Classic. Is a good one.
Can we get Clockwork?
Come on and get it.
Come up.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Have a good. Okay.